Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Lawrence O'Donnell, who is an Emmy-winning producer of NBC's The West Wing. He's also MSNBC's senior political analyst and a panelist on the McLaughlin Group. And he's a former Democratic Chief of Staff of the United States Senate Committee on Finance and the United States Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. He also served as a senior advisor to Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. We'll be talking to Lawrence O'Donnell about what may be happening in terms of the special prosecutor's case against those in the White House who leaked the identity of a CIA clandestine officer, Valerie Plame. And it seems to be winding down, and there may well be indictments quite soon. We'll be looking into who those indictments may be landed upon. And we'll also speak with Professor Douglas Laycock, who's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Texas and Austin School of Law. And he is we'll be talking to him about Harriet Myers, the new nominee, President Bush's personal lawyer, who he's nominated to become the Associate Supreme Court Justice to replace Sandra Day O'Connor. We're getting a local flavor of Harriet Myers' bio and her mentor, consort. We're looking into him as well. And we'll then talk with Wayne White, who is a scholar at the Washington Middle East Institute. He is recently retired as the Deputy Director of the Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia Bureau of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, INR. And he, during the March and April 2003 Iraq War, he took over as INR's principal Iraq analyst and subsequently headed INR's Iraq team. We're talking to him about President Bush's speech where previously in May the 1st of 2003, President Bush declared mission accomplished in Iraq, and just this week he said the same war that we've already won apparently is now turning into a global, has the portent of a global catastrophe. So we'll be looking into how come we have such a problem with the war we've already won. I'm now speaking with Lawrence O'Donnell, who, as I mentioned, is an Emmy-winning producer of NBC's The West Wing. He's also MSNBC's senior political analyst and a panelist on the McLaughlin Group. Formerly, he was the Democratic Chief of Staff for the United States Senate Committee on Finance and the United States Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. He also served as a senior advisor to Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. And we spoke a few months ago, Lawrence O'Donnell, just at the time when Time magazine had had turned over to the special prosecutor Matthew Cooper's work product, and you at that time broke the story on the McLaughlin Group that included in those what was sent over to the special prosecutor was that fact that Karl Rove was named as the source of the leak of Valerie Plame to Matthew Cooper. I believe that you've done some more sleuthing and have some more thoughts about who might well be indicted in the coming week or perhaps.
Yes, the Time magazine emails indicated that Matt Cooper's source was Karl Rove, and I had actually known that for several months by the time that I revealed it. I didn't want to get ensnared in the grand jury investigation at the time, and I didn't want to confuse the grand jury investigation. So I waited until the prosecutor actually had the emails and knew it when I said it. And we've now seen the case really heat up last week, which makes sense because there are, as of Monday, 12 working days left in the term of the grand jury that is sitting on this case. And so and Patrick Fitzgerald had said to the court that he really just needed the testimony of Matt Cooper and Judy Miller in order to complete his case. He just got the testimony of Judy Miller the week before last, and so he's now zeroing in on the end game. And now basically what you're seeing is a lot of legal panic on the part of Karl Rove and others who have been brought into that grand jury. And we've now learned in the last 24 hours that clarified something, actually, that had seemed to be the case prior to this, but now Rove's lawyer, masking himself as an unnamed source, is revealing a conversation between Rove and the president about this case after it had become public, in which, according to Rove's lawyer, Rove assured the president that he was not part of any scheme to discredit Joseph Wilson by revealing his wife's identity as a covert agent for the CIA. Now, that's a very elaborate statement to make to the president in that conversation. It suggests that the president's only question to Rove was, were you part of a scheme to discredit Joe Wilson by revealing that his wife is a covert agent at the CIA? That's not the way my president talks. If my president had a question for Rove, he's a very simple speaker, he would have said to him, did you talk to the press about this? Question mark. End of question.
Right. He would have prefaced that by saying, hey, Ted Blossom, have you talked to the president?
To which Rove would have had a choice of saying yes or lying. What Rove's lawyer is doing is communicating directly to the president and communicating to everyone else in the White House, hey, everybody, this is Rove's story. When you have to deal with Rove being indicted, or when you have to deal with whatever the outcome of this case is in your White House spin operation, this is the way you can say it. You can make the president look active and interested by asking this big elaborate question about a scheme to which Rove is allowed to say no. And by the way, I think Rove saying no to that question could very well be an honest answer, meaning he didn't feel himself to be involved in a scheme. He was just talking to Matt Cooper on his own, and he was talking to Bob Novak on his own, and he was just doing it on his own, not a big scheme involving other people. I can believe that that is technically true. I can also believe it's false, but, you know, it may end up being a defensible statement as far as it goes. The problem is that it's overbroad, and the president is going to be faced with the question from the press of, did you ever ask Karl Rove if he talked to reporters about this? Did you ever ask Karl Rove if he ever mentioned Wilson's wife to any reporters or to anyone? You know, the obvious kind of logical questions. But Rove's lawyer is trying to basically, through this last communication of his, he's trying to get the White House to go along with Rove's story. That's what that is.
And this will be the fourth time that Rove has appeared before the special prosecutor. Is it possible that having testified so often that there may be some inconsistencies?
Yes, I think he's definitely going in there to try to save himself from a perjury indictment, possibly among other things. But that is a reason to go back to a grand jury. It's happened. It can be done. The only crime you can actually talk your way out of is perjury, because it's a crime that you have to talk your way into. He did, definitely, according to the accounts that we now have, again, that have been leaked by Rove's lawyer in order to soften up the press for what's coming. Rove did, in my view, lie to the FBI, which is a federal crime, because it's now public information via Rove's lawyer that Rove did not tell the FBI in their interview with him that he was Matt Cooper's source.
In other words, that's a violation of making a false statement to a federal officer.
Which is a federal crime. You cannot lie to the FBI. So then he also, in his first grand jury appearance, said that his conversation with Matt Cooper was about welfare reform, not about Valerie Plame. That is perjury. So this prosecutor has him on perjury right now. Now, it is a legal process that includes the possibility of going back to the very same grand jury and saying, oops, I got it wrong. I forgot. I didn't remember that we talked about other things. And here's the other thing we talked about. So people have done that. People have survived grand jury processes that way, going in one day saying yes, coming back a couple weeks later saying, you know what, turns out the answer is no. And here is why I've changed my mind about my answer and my memory and all that stuff. This is not the kind of prosecutor who's going to buy that. And that's why, if you recall, there was intense attention. Matt Cooper couldn't quite understand it. When he came out of the grand jury and told us about his testimony, which, by the way, every single grand jury witness can, there is nothing that bounds a grand jury witness from walking out of the grand jury room, walking straight to the microphones and telling you everything they said, which parenthetically is what Judy Miller did not do. Matt Cooper did what a responsible reporter would do. Testify to the grand jury, then tell us every word he said. Tim Russert testified to this grand jury, came out and told us every word he said. Every other person in the press who's testified to this grand jury has come out and told us exactly what they said, except Judy Miller, which is an important point to remember as this thing's proceeding. So Matt Cooper came out and said, it was very strange. He was concentrating on how much I talked about welfare with Rove, and I couldn't quite understand it. It just seemed such a strange thing to concentrate on, because for Cooper, they didn't really talk about welfare at all. They talked about Valerie Plame. And so that is a case of, that's a makeable case of perjury against Rove right there. And Rove is now in this desperate last-minute attempt to talk his way out of it. Look, we've seen in this country, in effect, Bill Clinton talk his way out of perjury. It can be done. And I don't think Rove is going to pull that off. My own personal prediction is that Rove will face an indictment in this case. I don't believe he will be the only one. And I also think the prosecutor is in a situation where he might, which is rare, but he might use the status of unindicted co-conspirator on some of the other people that he's been studying in this case.
Lawrence O'Donnell, you mentioned Judy Miller's recently getting out of her 85-day jail term and not talking to the press. However, subsequently we found out that she's discovered notes from an earlier conversation she had with Scooter Libby in June following Nick Kristof's piece in the New York Times where Ambassador Wilson was an anonymous source, although not too hidden. And it turns out that the workup on Wilson preceded his op-ed piece, for which Novak retaliated. And apparently, I understand that as early as March, at the time of when the Iraq War was beginning, that was when the first meeting took place in the vice president's office with Scooter Libby and former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, where Libby was supposed to have said that bleep hole playboy who's off on his wife's boondoggles, we're going to have to deal with him. Would that indicate then that the special prosecutor is zeroing on the workup that was done and the timeline of the workup that was done on Wilson?
Well, what's very clear is that the prosecutor considers Libby's role in this case to be so serious that he was willing to put a New York Times reporter in jail for 3 months to find out about it, because the prosecutor had already told Judith Miller, all I want to talk to you about is Libby. Libby is the source I want to talk to you about. It wasn't a mystery to the prosecutor who Judith Miller had talked to. He knew who she had talked to based on phone records. He knew that these conversations had occurred. And so Judy Miller was in jail in order to avoid revealing her communications with Libby, and the prosecutor knew that. Now, if the prosecutor by that time in his investigation did not think that Libby was an absolutely critical component of putting this story together, then he would not have pushed her that far. And that, along with a lot of other surrounding material in this case, certainly raises Libby to indictment possibility number two.
And what would the indictment be in his case?
Well, this is where you would probably be getting into conspiracy counts. You would probably and also using this generally broader classified information statute. A lot of us were concentrating on the covert identity statute, which is a specific law about protecting covert identities of intelligence officers. A lot of us concentrated on that for a year, without moving over to thinking about what other broader classified information statutes might be usable in this kind of case. And I started staring at those statutes about 6 months ago, and that's when I realized what the scope of this could be. Because it's true what we've all said for a long time, which is this covert identities law is actually a very difficult one to break. It involves very, very specific components that would be hard to establish legally. But the thing to always remember about this case is we have to remember where it began. This is really, really important. It gets lost. The reason we have a special prosecutor on this case is because the CIA complained to the Justice Department about Valerie Plame's identity being revealed. The CIA took it so seriously that they went to the Attorney General and said, you've got to do something about this. And the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, at the time, started an investigation. And for Ashcroft, the investigation got so serious so fast that he had to recuse himself, do the honorable thing, and appoint a special prosecutor. That's who made this a serious case, okay? The CIA and John Ashcroft, those are the people who decided this is an extremely serious case.
But just to get the record straight, Larry O'Donnell, they dragged their heels, the Justice Department, for 6 months from the time that the CIA criminal referral went across to them.
Well, you can call it that. The procedures, I can tell you, I know people who've been involved in this investigation. None of them felt like the FBI was dragging their heels in coming after them. The FBI was closing in on White House personnel very, very quickly. And I think we might find, for example, that Rove's lie, with nothing else to call it, Rove's lie to an FBI agent may well have occurred under John Ashcroft's watch, before there even was a special prosecutor. That is possible. I don't think there are any real legitimate complaints out there about this investigation not being vigorous enough or not getting a quick enough start. I think this investigation has been handled with the utmost in professional care from the start, and I would include John Ashcroft in that.
Well, obviously, the Chapter 37 of the Federal Espionage and Censorship Law is an easier statute. Anybody else, just in closing? We've got Rove and Libby in jeopardy.
You know, I do have some specific ideas about other names, and I actually don't want to use them because I don't feel confident enough about them. And if they're not indicted, I don't want to be the guy out there who was saying so-and-so was going to get indicted. The reason I'm more comfortable with talking about Rove and Libby is that there's already a massive amount of public material about them and a very, very high likelihood of them being indicted if anyone's indicted. And so, and listen, I'll be the first to apologize and explain if Rove is not indicted, why I think he wasn't indicted. But that's what I think is going to happen. There's another very specific name that everyone would know that I have in mind that I just don't want to advance at this point. I don't have enough on it for it to be a responsible thing for me to say.
But what you've said so far, when you think about it, these are the deputies to the two most powerful men in the country.
It's devastating. I mean, this is one of those situations where all you need is the indictments for the situation to be absolutely devastating to them and, in effect, ruin their lives and to this presidency. And that is why Karl Rove is going back into the grand jury, because for him, conviction is almost, that's just a minor afterthought to indictment. If Karl Rove is indicted, then you have an complete disaster politically in the White House and in Rove's life and in Rove's career. I understand if I were in Karl Rove's shoes, I would be doing anything to avoid indictment, anything.
I thank you so much for joining us, Lawrence O'Donnell.
Thanks, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Lawrence O'Donnell, who's an Emmy Award-winning producer of NBC's The West Wing. He's also MSNBC senior political analyst and a panelist on the McLaughlin Group, where some months ago he first announced that Karl Rove was named as the source of the leak to the Time magazine. He is formerly the Democratic Chief of Staff of the United States Senate Committee on Finance and for the United States Senate Committee on the Environment and Public Works. He also served as a senior advisor to Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Let's now go to the subject of President Bush's nomination of his personal lawyer to become the next Supreme Court Justice. And I had to pre-record this, unfortunately, because Professor Douglas Laycock was not available in this live time zone.
I'm speaking with Professor Douglas Laycock, who's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Texas Austin School of Law. And Professor Laycock, you were quoted in the Los Angeles Times describing Harriet Meyer's longtime companion Nathan Hecht, who's a Texas Supreme Court justice, often said to be the most conservative justice on a very conservative court, that he's sort of the Antonin Scalia of that court, smart, aggressive, and very conservative. To begin with, why is this man getting so much press, almost as much as Harriet Meyer herself?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think it has to be because he is much better known to the conservative base than she is. And you know, if the president had nominated him to the Supreme Court, the base would not be divided and complaining. So they're bringing him out to vouch for her because he apparently knows her very well.
And he apparently has been in touch with James Dobson of Focus on the Family, who in turn has been in touch with Karl Rove. So he's essentially running interference from Harriet Myers?
That's what it looks like.
And what is your reading, you know, on her rather than on her longtime friend?
Well, you know, I don't know much about her, and I don't think anyone knows much about her except for the people who have been personally close to her. By all accounts, she's very smart. She works very hard. She rose to the top of a very good law firm. I think managing partner of a law firm is more about internal politics and bringing in business than it is about lawyerly skills, but by all accounts, she's got the lawyerly skills as well. She had a sort of business litigation practice, mostly involving issues that don't get to the Supreme Court very often. She simply has had no occasion to think about the issues before the court in any but the most superficial ways, and hardly anyone claims to have had a conversation with her about any of those issues. Now, you know, that's been true of a lot of justices in the past. You know, we would like to think that all presidents look around for one of the best qualified people, but that hasn't been how it's worked through American history. And some of the nominees who seemed wholly unprepared turned out to be terrific, and some turned out to be mediocrities. You just never know.
But I think, Professor Laycock, you're talking about sort of ancient history, aren't you? I mean, in the modern, so let's say in the post-war period.
Well,
how many lightweights could you point to in terms?
Well, and have you ever heard of Sherman Minton or Harold Burton or Charles Whitaker?
No.
They're all post-war justices of the Supreme Court. The first two were cronies of President Truman. I'm not sure where Whitaker came from. I think Whitaker came off a Court of Appeals. He had judicial experience, and uh-huh. He just wasn't up to the job. Sandra Day O'Connor. We could have said exactly the same thing about her in 1982. You know, that she'd been in a state legislature, she'd been on a state intermediate court of appeals. That was interesting and valuable experience, but she had had no occasion to think about much about the issues that come before the Supreme Court. And you know, she turned out to be fine.
Well, of course, now in the context of Harriet Myers, she is being described as a sage compared to this neophyte.
Well, you know, in part because we know so much more about her, she's proved herself over the years, and, you know, in part because as the country keeps moving further and further to the right, you know, Democrats who were opposed to a new conservative justice in her early days come to think of her as not so bad compared to what the next appointment might be like. Right? So, you know, once she retires, she becomes a model for people who are trying to push the president in a moderate direction. The same thing happened to Justice Powell when he retired in 86. O'Connor was a good judge, and people grow into this job sometimes. David Souter had very little federal experience and sometimes jokes with his law clerks that he learns a new amendment each year. That's obviously an exaggeration. He's been a fine justice, but he learned much of the federal law he's learned after he got there. Harriet Myers may do the same thing. The problem is there's just no way to know.
Well, of course, in Justice Souter's case, he's almost become a catchphrase for conservatives saying, no, we don't want another Souter.
Well, that's right.
And
yeah, they're not happy with the way he learned the federal law. They're not happy with the way he votes. But it would be hard to criticize Justice Souter on grounds of, you know, legal ability or his ability to fully understand the issues that are now before the court. Yeah, and those are really two different questions. I mean, you know, John Roberts is as superbly qualified as any nominee I could think of, and that's true whether you agree with him or disagree with him. Now, you may not like the way he's going to vote, and I think it's entirely legitimate for senators to vote not to confirm simply because of how they fear he's going to vote. But on technical quality and legal talent preparation grounds, you could not have designed a career to better prepare somebody for the Supreme Court than the one John Roberts has had. And part of what's hurting Harriet Myers is the contrast between her and Roberts coming so close together.
Yes, well, I think it's by no means a shoo-in because of that. But how do you feel, though, Douglas Laycock, about the fact that this the Justice Roberts, now the Supreme the head justice now of the Supreme Court, he is formerly a presidential lawyer,
right?
And Harriet Myers is this president's lawyer,
right?
And clearly, both of them will have a bias towards the executive branch. And here we are in a context where more and more executive powers seem to be going President Bush's way. There's even talk, or at least disquiet, about the notion of overturning the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act in terms of federal response to, say, avian flu. That came up in the press conference a couple of days ago. I can just list a few things here. President Bush, just in the last few weeks, has formed the National Security Service, which the president controls. It's arguably America's first secret police. The Fourth Circuit have given President Bush the power to declare a U.S. citizen an enemy combatant. The Senate Select Intelligence Committee is now allowing the Pentagon to spy on American citizens and gather data. The president has just threatened to veto a huge defense bill because of amendment that passed 90-9 in the Senate, proposed by John McCain to restrict or ban torture. The president's threatening to overturn that, reserving the right, presumably, to, you know, ban torture. So there goes the Eighth Amendment. And then you've got the Patriot Act II, where there's the administrative subpoenas are allowed. That sort of more or less shreds what's left of the Fourth Amendment.
Well, that's a scary list. I think the scariest item on it is the president's claim that he can arrest any American citizen anytime, any place on his own say-so. There's no right to a lawyer. There's no right to a judicial review. There's no right to know the charges against you. The only reason American people tolerate that is he hasn't used it much, but he hasn't used it against people who look like ordinary Americans. That's really why it's been tolerated, but it's an astonishing claim of authority. And I think, you know, yeah, I think the basic point of your question is right. These two nominees are likely to be safe votes for broad executive authority, and my guess, frankly, would be in the course of picking judges, this president cares more about that issue, cares more about his power to do whatever he wants without restriction by Congress or the courts than he does about the hot-button issues that most of the press is more interested in, abortion and Ten Commandments displays and the other culture war issues. You know, the Democrats can't do anything with this expansive claim of power, the power to arrest everybody, because they're constantly on the defensive that they're soft on the war on terror. And the American public just doesn't see the significance of the kinds of claims the president is making. Until their neighbors start getting arrested, you know, they're not. As long as it's only, you know, people from the Middle East who get arrested, it's just not an issue that plays very well politically.
Yes, curiously, it's actually there's rather than the reaction being on the left, it seems to be more on the right with libertarians and the far right that's concerned about the Posse Comitatus Act being overturned.
Well, I think that's right. I think the libertarians see this issue more clearly than the average citizen does.
So what is it? What's your prescription in terms of politics here? Is there any groundswell here likely to happen where people will start revisiting the notion of the separation of powers? It always strikes me as extraordinary in these nomination and votes on these nominees in the Senate that as an institution, this deliberative advice and consent body doesn't seem to want to protect its own prerogatives and seems to be so much in line with the president, at least the Republicans seem to be.
Well, it is remarkable. When presidents of both parties have sold this bill of goods that they're entitled to whoever they want on the Supreme Court, and the Senate should just check to make sure they're minimally qualified. That was never the point of the confirmation process. The judges don't work for the president. They're in an independent branch. And the president and the Senate have an equal voice in deciding who the justices are going to be. But the president has an enormous bargaining advantage because there's only one of him, and he can stay united and pursue an agenda. There are 100 senators. It's hard to get them all together. And the president's own party tends to support him. It hasn't always been that way, but in the current polarized state in Washington, the 55 Republicans seem to vote in lockstep. Even the moderate Republicans, aren't many of them left, but even they vote for the president's nominees, probably for fear of retaliation if they don't. So it's very difficult for the Democrats with only 45 votes to seriously oppose a nominee. And I think, to sustain a filibuster, they've got to get the people behind them. Otherwise, a filibuster becomes a political battle over who gets blamed for the obstruction. Is it the president's fault for nominating an extremist, or is it the Democrats' fault for being obstructionist? And with Roberts, the Democrats didn't have a chance to win that battle because they didn't have any sound bites that made him sound extremist, and he was superbly qualified. They don't have any sound bites on Harriet Myers either, and the relative lack of qualifications, the cronyism charge is going to be a hard sell politically, I think. And the Democrats also have to worry about, if they defeat her, who do they get next? And especially if the reason they defeat her is they pick up 6 or 8 hardline conservative Republican votes who aren't satisfied with her. And, if she goes down because of Republican defections on the right, the next nominee may be worse from a Democratic perspective. So, I don't know how the politics are going to play out. I certainly don't know what senators are going to decide. But, I suspect she's going to have a very rough confirmation journey and, in the end, probably be confirmed.
And why would it be that the Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid jumped out of the gate so early in supporting her, although he's sort of somewhat backtracked?
Right.
If as you suggest, that some of the far right may vote against already Trent Lott and Senator Brownback have indicated they're not thrilled with her, they'd have to be joined by senators on the left.
Well, they would have to be. I don't know what Senator Reid was thinking, but one plausible guess is something like this. This woman is a blank slate. The fact that she has not had occasion to think about the kinds of issues that come before the court is a good thing. It's the best we can hope for from the Democratic side. She'll come in with some political predisposition in the president's way, but with no settled or worked out views. She'll be open to persuasion in a way that most of the names that were being bandied about are not. So somebody who has a well-developed judicial philosophy, has thought about these issues in legal terms, knows how to give legal reasons for the results he wants to reach, is much harder to turn around or persuade towards the center than somebody who comes in as something of a blank slate. The most conservative Republicans worry about that, and Harry Reid might have viewed that as a benefit.
But he also might have been sort of sandbagging the Republicans by supporting her so quickly, therefore the right would have to assume that there's something wrong with her.
That's possible.
But just in closing, then, it seems to me that that maybe there is, when you say that she may be influenced, if she's going to be influenced, it's quite possible that she'll be influenced by Scalia and Thomas more than anybody else.
It's entirely possible.
If indeed her consort and friend is, as you describe, the Texas version of Scalia.
This is all so speculative because, you know, she doesn't have a record and we don't know.
Apparently, at least the Reverend Dobson is saying, the Focus on the Family fellow is saying that Karl Rove assured him that she would overturn Roe v. Wade. Whether that carries any weight or is hearsay, but still.
Yeah, and how does Rove know, right? If he asked her and she answered, that's a serious problem. If he's just guessing,
right.
he knows more than the rest of us do, but not that much. She could become, she could grow into the job and become her own person on the court and do things that will surprise all of us. She could be a passive vote and just follow the lead of Nino Scalia. Yeah, she could drift to the center or even the left, as O'Connor and Souter did. We're all guessing, but we do know she has a very conservative background.
Right? And a very pro-corporate background. She's basically,
right.
Her experience as a corporate lawyer has been fighting on behalf of huge corporations like Microsoft, where she's handled trademark infringement work for the Walt Disney Company, and she's also handled the Catholic Church in terms of it trying to reduce its exposure to suits from the abuse victims of Dallas area priests.
So. Well, on the corporate issue, she may have more of a thought out view. She's done 20 years of business and commercial litigation, and she may know more about what she thinks on those questions. And those questions do get to the Supreme Court sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Not as often as some of the other things, but they do get up there.
Well, that's, you know, one of the reasons why I'm skeptical about all of this talk about judicial original intent and judicial versus judicial activism. It seems to me that if you really step back and look at the record of Thomas and Scalia, it's essentially about voting for the powerful over the powerless.
It's a little more complicated than that, but that does explain a lot of it. The claim about judicial activism is just a slogan, and you know what the two sides politically want is for the court to vote with them on all the issues, and you really saw that when. In the Terry Schiavo case, when the judge was accused of judicial activism, the federal courts were accused of judicial activism because they didn't interfere with the state court proceeding. That is, doing nothing became activist because the people making the charge wanted the court to do something. Or this eminent domain case last year where the court deferred to the legislature and said the legislature gets to decide what serves a public purpose, and they were accused of judicial activism. Those are both very restrained decisions, and you know, what made them, there was nothing activist about them. What caused them to draw the activism charge was that one side of the political spectrum just didn't like the result. And activism sounds better to the average voter who isn't paying too close attention than I didn't like the result.
Well, I guess, again, it comes back to the people, you know, and the extent of their engagement in this. If the people's voices aren't heard, then the powerful's voices are heard by default.
Well, that tends to be how political systems work.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to do it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Marcus. I'm just speaking then with Professor Douglas Laycock, who's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Texas Austin School of Law, and that was pre-recorded, explaining the bad quality, which I apologize for, but he wasn't available in this live slot. I'm now speaking with Wayne White, who is a scholar at Washington's Middle East Institute. In March of 2005, he retired as the Deputy Director of the Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia in the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, otherwise known as INR. During the March and April 2003 Iraq War, he took over as INR's principal Iraq analyst and subsequently headed INR's Iraq team from August 2003 through March 2005. and Wainwright. Obviously, President Bush's speech on Thursday was supposed to be a moment of clarity, or at least to clarify the situation in Iraq. It did strike me as being somewhat extraordinary that a president who back in May of 2003 had declared mission accomplished is now saying essentially that the war that we already won, we can't afford to lose.
I think that's a great way to put it, Ian, because I have the same reaction. Essentially, what we're being told now in that speech, and I thought it was significant, was that instead of the vision that the administration said it was entering that war with, to use Iraq as a model democracy to democratize the region, now it was he was essentially saying that what our objective is to prevent the other side from turning Iraq into sort of a center of Islamic militant terror that could spread throughout the entire Muslim world, even beyond the Middle East. And so I think, in essence, whether he wants to admit it or not, he's turned from defense, offense to defense in the vision toward Iraq.
Well, recently, Ambassador Charles Freeman, who represented the United States in Saudi Arabia during the first Gulf War, said, I'm just quoting here, "The Anglo-American invasion of Iraq cost my country thousands of lives, eroded the American military, and destroyed the Iraq's state. It has generated at least three different insurgencies and, by some estimations, multiplied our enemies 10 times. Look at the resurgent Taliban in Afghanistan. Iraq has become the cause of the very problem it was supposed to control."
Well, this is Chaz Freeman's a good friend of mine, and I think, you know, Chaz is moving in the right direction. What most Americans do not understand, and I'm amazed when I talk to people that they still can't get about this, is that 90% of the insurgents that we are fighting, you know, in Iraq, because still my sources tell me 90% of the insurgency is local, not foreign fighters coming in through Syria and, you know, basically connected with al-Qaeda and hooking up with al-Zarqawi and the more extremist elements. 90% of the insurgents in Iraq are Iraqis. These are people who, if we hadn't come to their cities and towns, what have you, would not have been involved in violence, you know, against us. They would not have gotten on a plane and gone to New York. And so we have put ourselves in the middle of this situation. In fact, it always reminds me of a quote by Shelby Foote in one of those great Civil War programs on PBS some years ago, when he noted a conversation between a Union officer asking a Confederate soldier late in the war why he was still fighting. And he said, "Because you're here." And for many insurgents, that's why they're fighting.
Well, the insurgents are largely Sunni, and it seems that for all of our talk about building an army to take over, when they stand up, we stand down, as the president says. The army that we're building, and albeit the top brass just last week had to say, well, instead of the three trained battalions we told you about, we're down to one. But what we have, whether it's one or whatever, it's basically a Shiite and a Kurd army. And many people warned that this process towards an election and a referendum on a constitution would in fact expose the contours of a civil war rather than bring the country together. Brent Scowcroft, for one. So where do you put us at the moment? It seems with this election coming up this referendum coming up in next week, it does seem to be at a critical juncture. Do you think that Scowcroft will be proven right, that rather than bring the country together, it'll tear it apart?
Well, the country in some ways is tearing itself apart in a continuous process. It's going to be just so hard to get Sunni Arabs to accept the fact that their country, what they regarded as their country, isn't under their ownership anymore. This is one of the most critical things that we have to work on, and unfortunately, in the course of the political march forward, basically, in many ways, the Sunni Arabs have been left behind. The Shia and the Kurds, who have suffered under Sunni Arab rule, are in many ways trying to make up for that, you know, by grabbing as big a piece of the pie for themselves as possible at a time when they need to be reaching out as as forcefully as possible to do just the opposite, to include the Sunni Arabs. It's ironic, in fact, when the you hear even the military on the Hill just recently talking about how encouraging it is that the Sunni Arabs are turning out in large numbers or plan to for the election. No, they're turning out in large numbers because they want to reject the political process and they want to, you know, basically veto the Constitution. And so that turnout is meaningless except perhaps in the context of their continued rejection generally of the political process as currently defined. So, no, the referendum is not going to put us, you know, back into a process where we have a lot of forward momentum. If I can add one more thing, one of the things that has never been understood by the administration, and I began saying it over a year before I left government, in both briefings and in writing, is that the administration is moving forward under the assumption that the further we go on this process of sort of ticket punching, election, referendum, et cetera, momentum will build and things will get easier. And the fact is that it's going to get harder, and we're already seeing that. Why? Because the reason we got as far as we got up to about January 30th is that we kept saying, and the Iraqi parties in control kept saying, it's temporary. The transitional law is temporary. Don't worry about it. We'll sweat the details later. Well, now is later. And all those cans being kicked down the road through 2003 and 2004 have now come home to roost. And now's when the real bickering starts, and we're seeing it.
Well, Wayne White, is it possible that people like Scowcroft and Colin Powell was the only, I wouldn't call it a dissenting voice, but at least he said to the president apparently prior to the invasion that use the pottery barn analogy, if you break it, you own it. Is it possible that in a sense that once you do break it, which we've done, that inevitably you will hand the most valuable part, the eastern part where most of the oil is, to the Iranians, the Kurds, who have essentially been sitting it out at any rate? They seem to be pretty much on the fence and not particularly invested in this referendum. Obviously, if they were to declare an autonomy, the Turks may not be happy about that. And then inevitably, the people that dominated the place, the Sunni, will end up, they don't have any oil. Obviously, their surrogates in Saudi Arabia, the Gulf, and Jordan are concerned about the notion of a Shia crescent. So as you look at that, as the China has been broken, isn't it inevitable then? Or is it, well, let me suggest this. Has it already become a surrogate war, in effect, between those that support the Sunni, the Saudis, the Jordanians, and the Gulf Arabs, and those that support the Shia, the Iranians?
It could be already a war. In certain parts of the country, those kinds of retaliatory killings and actions are taking place. And Zarqawi, of course, is trying very, very hard to target in a way that would propel the country towards civil war. In other words, using a lot of his car bombings, et cetera, to target Shia mosques, Shia areas, in order to generate this Sunni Arab and particularly Shia violence, which a number of the militants under his command would definitely advocate, even if this had never gotten started in another way. But we did take the lid off the pot, and now it is boiling. And civil war is a definite possibility. And you mentioned something very important, which I think a lot of people don't focus on. I hear all too many times, well, there really can't be a civil war because the Sunni Arabs don't have oil, the Kurds do, and the Shia do. But a point they're missing, as you probably know, is that if this ever broke out, the Turks would probably instantly turn off the oil tap to the Kurds, so they would have no oil. If they showed any inclination toward independence, which I think they would almost irresistibly move toward in such a scenario, and in fear that the Sunni Arabs would be overtaken by Shia, all the countries you named, Egypt, Jordan, Syria, even the Saudis and various Gulf states, in fear of a Shia Islamic Republic in the south or a Shia-dominated Iraq more greatly, will pour the guns, money, and whatever the Sunni Arabs need in order to fight. And we have to keep in mind that the Sunni Arabs represent the military, the peak or the tip of the military expertise of that country, military engineering, high command, intelligence services. They know how to fight. They know how to drive the tanks. If they get the stuff, they'll fight. And in answer to people who say, well, you see, they'll just kind of separate into nicely governed parts and it won't be so bad, then we have the problem of Baghdad. It's about 40% Sunni and 60% Shia. Who gets Baghdad? There is the possibility we could end up with a Beirut-like situation in Baghdad with a big line down the middle, buildings in rubble as people sort out. And, of course, there are many mixed areas in the country which would have to sort out in sort of an ethnic cleansing manner before they could settle into enclaves that were reasonably homogeneous.
Mm-hmm. There's a sizable Kurdish population in Baghdad, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There are at least 100,000 Kurds, maybe even more. In Baghdad, there are Christians, Turkmen, a number of other minorities with divided loyalties, you know, pointing in one direction or the other.
Well, if Wayne White, as your colleague Ambassador Charles Freeman, former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, suggests that America's invasion of Iraq has become America's Syracuse, referring back to the early Greeks, where Sparta was happy to see Athens waste its strength against a meaningless opponent. Do you see this as some kind of geopolitical Waterloo for the United States, and not in this case being on the French side of Waterloo rather than the British?
Well, the problem is that it is wasting so much of our assets. There are so many demands we hear all the time from state governors, mayors of cities, et cetera, and I'm not just talking about Katrina and the damage. I'm talking about homeland security writ large, you know, what the Coast Guard needs to do with its job, what local police forces in major cities need, customs, FBI, et cetera. And this is tens of billions of dollars needed for all that are basically going into Iraq. And we really can't afford that. And one of the things that has been hurt by the Iraqi venture is the situation in Afghanistan. We never finished the job in Afghanistan. It requires much more money. It could have been easily better done with twice as many troops. That probably would have encouraged our allies to commit more. Afghanistan is very, very shaky. And one of the things that's disturbing some of us, or of concern to some of us, is the fact that we're just beginning now to see some of the same tactics, copycat-like tactics, being used in Afghanistan, car bombs, things like that, IEDs. And so we may actually find out that in the coming months, Afghanistan becomes sort of an Iraq-type thing simmering at a lower boil.
Well, you know, some of the critics of this administration say that, you know, just going back to FDR, he always said you've got to separate your political, the people who help you get elected from the people who help you govern, and you shouldn't sort of cross-fertilize. Mm-hmm. And there's a criticism of this administration that all of its decisions are political, and to some extent it's a public relations operation masquerading as a government. That criticism aside, there's no question that the critical October 2002 vote in the United States Senate to authorize war was not a profile in courage, shall we say.
Right.
And Ambassador Freeman, again, his diagnosis for this is that if this war in Iraq is actually not diagnosis, but his kind of melancholy is that this war in Iraq is in fact a war against ourselves, and that just quoting from him, the party adversary system in America has broken down. Patriotism is confused with accepting whatever policy the government lays down. There is no national discussion on the war at all. More telling was the lack of debate even in Congress over the war. This is not, he averred strongly, just a political problem. It's a systemic breakdown in America. Would you agree with that?
There's a lot there, Ian.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I can sort all that out as clearly as Chaz could or you. But one thing that has made me very, very unhappy is the way the debate is breaking down in this country. And there is a lot of the, you know, you're not supporting the troops unless you're going to basically stay the course. And, of course, there's absolutely no definition of what staying the course means except kind of just staying. And the debate is often between people just say, you know, stay the course, you know, don't bother about the details, we'll take care of it, et cetera, and that's insufficient, and that's very, very dangerous. And then on the other side, you have the let's get out now gang. And that's the solution is not right there, is not there either. At least we've got to go through with the referendum. We have to go through with the, you know, upcoming elections. I would like to see withdrawals start early next year. Frankly, I'd like to see us set a date for withdrawal. I think the president's right. If you set a date, for once he's right, set a date a year out, and the insurgents will simply wait you out. But if you set a date 3 or 4 years out, you will put to lie a lot of the conspiracy theories presently out in Iraq that we're going to stay forever. And that's very potent out there. Or that we want bases. Another very strong conspiracy out there. And if we set a date for withdrawal and we said we're not interested in bases unless a sovereign Iraqi government down the road asks us, I think we can actually get rid of some of the baggage that we are, you know, dragging behind us right now. But if we set a date 3 or 4 years out, there's nobody who can wait us out if this is going to work. But on the other hand, if it hasn't worked by that time, we should be gone.
I thank you very much for joining us, Wayne White.
Thank you, Ian.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking to Wayne White, who is a scholar at the Washington Middle East Institute. He is formerly the Deputy Director of the Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia in the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, otherwise known as INR. They, by the way, are the only people who got the Iraq War right in the intelligence community prior to the war. During the March-April 2003 Iraq War, he took over as INR's principal Iraq analyst and subsequently headed INR's Iraq team from August 03 through March 05. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Jazz Shepherd, the engineer, Rusty Wynn and Carol Coots, the assistant producer. A special thanks to Walter Douglas for engineering the pre-recorded interview. This program and all previous programs are available at ianmasters.org, where there's also podcasting.